thank you all for being here. And we're going, the order is going to be Tom, Lynn, Jeff, and Raul. And I'll just give quick bios. Professor Tom Tomich is founding director of Agricultural Sustainable Institute here at UC Davis and inaugural holder of the W.K. Kellogg and now chair in Sustainable Food Systems at UC Davis, where he teaches Sustainable Agriculture and Food Systems major. And he also directs the UC statewide Sustainable Agricultural Research and Education Program. For Lynn, Lynn Epstein is a professor of plant pathology here at UC Davis with an interest in sustainable agriculture and plant disease control. And she also has a breeding interest, including in celery. Thanks very much for coming, Jennifer. Jeffrey Herrick is a soil scientist with the USDA Agricultural Research Center. Research Service in Las Cruz, New Mexico, and he is also a leader in the Jornada program. He has led and co-led the development of several rangeland inventory assessment monitoring acknowledgement management tools that are applied to national scales in the U.S. and internationally. He serves on the International Resource Panel, the BLM National Science Committee, and leads the Global Land Potential Knowledge System Project, which, am I correct, has apps in circulation. Okay, thanks very much. And Raul Adamczyk has been farming organically for 30 years and is presently the market garden coordinator at the UC Davis Student Farm. He has served as the president of Board of California Certified Organic Farmers. Raul is a co-author with his wife, Pam Ronald, of the book Tomorrow's Table, Organic Farming, Genetics, and the Future of Food. And again, thank you all for being here. And we'll begin with Tom.
Thanks, Rich, for organizing this and for this opportunity. A number of us are from UC Davis, not everybody, but we work closely with USDA. UC Davis is one of the co-hosts for this meeting. I thought I'd start with just a little bit about agricultural sustainability and UC Davis and then talk more specifically about the Agricultural Sustainability Institute and some of our programs. I'm not going to use PowerPoint. I will just speak. As in Rich's kind introduction, I'm the guy that has sustainability and sustainable agriculture all over my business card. So I often get asked the question, what does sustainability mean? What is sustainable agriculture? And in fact, as I'm going to be talking about this, an active part of our research is really about answering that question. What are the things that you have to look at? I think we all realize it's multidimensional, but what is the short list of issues you really, really have to consider? I'm also going to talk not just about the ideas that have to be included in the concept, but I think it's helpful to know something about what we actually do and how we pursue it. I'm an economist by training. What I do now at this stage in my life is really about the interaction between complex social systems and complex ecological systems. And if you think about agriculture and farming, it really epitomizes the interaction of that complexity. I'm also at least still somewhat grounded in reality. I grew up on a farm here in the Sacramento Valley. My family has been farming for 119 years here. My parents still farm about, if we were to jump in a car, we could be there in 20 minutes. First about UC Davis, Raul, Lynn, and I are all members of the College of Agricultural and Environmental Sciences, and that "and" is, I think, an interesting conjunction because in California now, especially during the drought, it's often portrayed as agriculture versus environmental, not our college, but the issues. So one way of thinking about what we're trying to do is really how do we make it an "and" verse instead of the "versus"? How do we think about agriculture and working landscapes in a way that is framed within a sustainability context? I joined UC Davis nearly 10 years ago, after much of my career working outside the U.S. When I came to set up this Agricultural Sustainability Institute, I think there was more than a few of my colleagues who were wondering, you know, well, sustainability, isn't that ideology and fluff? Is there really science to it? And I think one of the transitions both within our campus and within the state has been to see the scientific core of sustainability much more clearly and to see it as a legitimate topic for both research and education, but also for action. So we have a new dean. Dean Dillard has been leading our college for the last 2 years. There was a new strategy for the college, and sustainable agriculture is now one of the top priorities for the College of Agricultural and Environmental Sciences. That's a new thing. The other thing that I'm kind of contractually obligated to say is UC Davis is the number one college of agriculture in the United States and arguably one of the top two on the planet in terms of agriculture, forestry, research, and education. So it having this commitment to sustainability in agriculture for what is recognized as one of the most excellent places for that work is important. So this question that Rich posed to us, when we set up the Agricultural Sustainability Institute 10 years ago, we had a lot of consultations about what the meaning, what a vision for a sustainable food system would be. And I just wanted to share some of those. It's about innovation, adaptation, and profitability. So for the business angle, for example, that's part of the realm of sustainability. It's about access to healthy food for everybody. So there's a social justice component to this too, which is extremely important. It's about prosperity and equity for people working in agriculture. So there's a new movement about food system workers. So the recognition of inequity in farm worker benefits and salaries, but the kind of the extension of that throughout the food system. So people working in fast food, people working in food processing. Again, social justice once again. That the potential for a sustainable food system to make a positive contribution to environmental and human health. So not to be the problem, but to be the solution. And then the two final points, which I think surprise people, but I particularly want to emphasize for a group of journalists, is building awareness and understanding of the food system by the public is a key element of actually getting us to a sustainable food system. And the second half of that is that we feel it's extremely important to engage public participation in getting the food system we want. And what does that even mean? But so the role that you all play in terms of building public awareness and public action to move us all towards sustainability on the planet is extremely important. Now, just that's the vision for the future. And I would say maybe we're a generation away from attaining that. I think one of the most important things I do is my educational role, because our students are going to be the people who have to take this forward. But let me just mention a handful of things. And how am I doing on time? You
about 5 minutes.
Okay, 5 minutes more?
Sure.
Okay.
5 or 7.
Okay. The first thing on my list of what we do is we aspire to educate the next generation of leaders through hands-on experience. And one of the great things about my institute is we have a 25-acre organic farm that's very close to the center of the campus. So students get hands-on experience with organic agriculture. And my colleague Raul Adamczyk, who's going to be in the final word here, Raul works there and leads that effort. In California, only about 2 or 3% of the population actually grows up or is directly involved in agricultural production. Increasingly, our students come from San Diego, LA, San Francisco. The farm where Raul works is probably, for many of them, their first experience in a farm field. The other thing we do is we have another facility called the Russell Ranch Sustainable Agriculture Facility, which is a 285-acre. It's a data generator. So like the Large Hadron Collider is to particle physics, the Russell Ranch facility is to agriculture. It generates the fundamental process-based information. We grow corn out there for NASA. I love to say that. You have a chance to visit there this afternoon. There's the fish-to-fields tour. Is that right, Kat? fish to farms, something. So the, we don't do the fish, but if you stick, if you the fish is great, but you'll get to the farm too. Nobody has one of these things. You can see ours. It's about asking the fundamental questions about linking climate, energy, water, soil, labor to production of food. One of the few places where you can actually do scientifically valid comparisons between organic and conventional. We have spent a lot of time, 7 years, working on the nitrogen cycle in California. And you'd think, nitrogen, just another element on the periodic table. Turns out it's a really hot-button issue politically in California. We've upset people completely across the political spectrum. One of the things that would be interesting to discuss is actually how do we do science to engage with politically contentious high-stakes issues that people almost inevitably view from very different lenses. And one of the issues about the nitrogen assessment was it's not even there's not even a consensus about it being a problem. And if you're interested, so we just published a book, but I also have a stack of these are 18-page summaries of what it's about. But that was very much about a major theme of my work, which is how do we ask the right questions? And so I really wanted to make three points. And one of the points is, in fact, the central point is that this transition to sustainability in food and agriculture has to be science-based, and it's going to be information-intensive. Okay, so we're not talking about going back to 15th century agriculture. The second point, which was the nitrogen assessment was really about, is we're really just beginning to ask the right questions about what a sustainable food system is. And when we started the nitrogen assessment 7 years ago, we didn't even know, we thought that it was going to be about climate change, and it ended up actually being about groundwater contamination by nitrates. So we have to do some really fundamental, really basic, not necessarily challenging methodologically or conceptually, but we're asking a whole new set of questions that evidence can bring to bear. We need to be partnered with you folks about getting this information out to the public so that there's even awareness of these issues. We also work with through our statewide extension program on improving the well-being of farm workers and food system workers. So there's a social justice dimension. We work with small-scale and ethnic farmers to expand their markets in California. And at the same time, we work with some of the biggest food companies on the planet to ensure sustainable sources of raw materials. And I'll just say two more sentences, if that's okay. One of our values is about inclusion. So we're there for anybody who wants to improve their practices in terms of sustainability. Among 5-acre strawberry farmer in the San Joaquin Valley or Mars Incorporated, so the third biggest food processing company on the planet. There's not a political litmus test or a scale test. Even if we were to increase the amount of organic production in the state fourfold, that would take us from 5% to 20% of our food supply in California. We might be able to make that 20% within 15 years, 20 years. Even if we attain that, there'd still be 80% of the food system whose footprint, both socially and environmentally, we'd have to deal with. But the thing that happened when we started working with Mars Incorporated and later what was Heinz and Barilla and other companies were into, what could be a scientifically credible, science-based claim for comprehensive sustainability for a food company? The smart way that people have done this is, or the easy way, is to take one commodity, palm oil or beef or something like that, and to say, well, we're going to worry about three things. What we tried to do was to worry about all things on land and all the possibilities in terms of concerns. And it turns out it's not three things, but it might be between 12 and 20 things. So it's a finite list. Some of those are easier to measure than others. And I think some kind of a discussion about what needs to be on that list, how are we going to measure it, how are we going to benchmark sustainability, and most importantly, how are we going to be able to have a conversation at the political level about managing trade-offs within that list is one of the great questions for this century. And I'll stop with that.
Questions for the end, if you have like one compelling question anybody wants to ask. Okay, we'll save for the end. Thanks. And we're going to have Lynn Epstein's PowerPoint now and presentation.
You have to hold it down.
Do the lights or something.
Just hold that button down.
I wanted to thank you all for the work that you do. It was really critical work.
Just for 2 seconds.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, sorry.
It's coming.
There we go.
Okay.
There you go.
All right. So I wanted to do two things. I want to start and tell you a little bit about my take on sustainability and then move into an area that I've been interested in. I primarily work on fungi and fungal diseases of plants, but I've been interested in the question of particularly we have a national policy in many places, an international policy of promoting integrated pest management is a great way of reducing pesticide risk. And so I've tried to use pesticide use reports database to assess whether that's true or not. And I've come to the conclusion it's not. And so I'd like to show you a little bit of pesticide data and a couple of case studies from California to indicate why I've come to that conclusion. So in terms of an assessment of sustainability, what I would really like to see included is a understanding of how much energy are we putting into the system and making sure that our food value is greater than that amount of energy, right? It's not truly going to be a sustainable system unless we have a net photosynthetic. So we have to take into account all of the energy that's used for fossil fuel manipulations in the field and fertilizer and irrigation, etc. And so the big point is that in California, in the U.S., we put in much more energy into particularly our fruits and vegetables than we do than we get out of them. And in my mind, that's not sustainable. And we had a little bit of discussion about the second criteria that I would say agricultural production does not diminish the quantity or quality of the natural resources or ecosystem services, and then something about social justice, agricultural system benefits both the food producers and the consumers. See, here's just a little data from Pimentel on the amount of energy inputs that we put into typical apple production in the U.S. and how much energy we get out, and we put in about 5 times more than we get out. In the field crops, in the U.S. and in much of the, in particularly in the lesser developed countries, we get more energy out of the crops than we put into it. In the U.S., we have much greater yields than we do in other parts, but we also get out less energy. So those things have, I think, got to change in terms of sustainability. And that, to me, is going to be a huge challenge as we come into the 21st century. I'll just go over this one. And the challenges I think we have of achieving greater sustainability is that we don't have full cost pricing for the inputs. We don't include the externalities. It's a concept I'm sure you're all familiar with. And we have an agricultural production system in the U.S. and that we've promoted throughout the world that really is in maximizing yield, not in maximizing the amount of net calories that we get in the crop. So could we make more progress in sustainable agriculture? Absolutely. Will we? And that's the question, and it's not just a question that needs science. It's really a question that really needs a combination of science and social progress. So I want to switch now and talk a little bit about pesticides. pesticides. And so we're coming still from a history of where pesticides were a great idea.
I've got that poster.
So this is an ad from 1947 in Time magazine. The DDT is good for me. Here's a picture in the middle of a woman nursing her baby about how DDT. And no question, DDT has been good for certain things, but it's also had huge environmental consequences. So following that, 1962, this is a report to workers from the University of California, one Riverside, one Berkeley, fumigating soil for strawberry production enhances yield. And it enhances yield in the absence of any pathogens. We don't entirely understand the mechanism of that still. 1962, same year that Silent Spring came out, and same year that other scientists at University of California at Berkeley really started the biological control emphasis, saying that these pesticides often had adverse agricultural effects, and that just massive fumigation was not always a great idea. So we've had the development of the concept of integrated pest management, which has been promoted in the U.S. and throughout the world as a great way of reducing our pesticide reliance. And so it's been defined as ecosystem-based strategy. This is the UC IPM definition. Ecosystem-based strategy that focuses on long-term prevention of pests or their damage through a combination of practices such as biological control, habitat manipulation, modification of cultural practices, and use of resistant varieties. And then you only use pesticides as a last resort when you know the pathogen is present. So I gave you one example with strawberries. Fumigation before you plant, you don't know whether you have any pathogens at all. Certainly not part of any. Well, yeah, you probably all heard the expression that in theory and practice are the same, in practice they're different. And so in theory, we use a wide range of non-chemical mechanisms. In practice, we primarily rely a great deal upon pesticides. So you can ask the question, well, to what extent do we have benefits from pesticides when we look at the externalities or control concern? This is a 2016 article that concludes that our pesticide use, the cost of pesticide use might have outreached its benefits in the U.S. by about 1990s. So anyway, let's look at a little bit of what we're doing in terms of pesticide while we're promoting to the public that we're using the least amount necessary. Not quite true. So this is glyphosate compound in Roundup Ready. Increased between 1992 and 2014, Chuck Benbrook's data from the USDA. And that's partly been driven by our genetically engineered crops. So the promoters of I think genetic engineering is a great way of getting resistance into plants, but the idea that it's necessarily going to lead to less pesticide use is not true. Major use of genetic engineering right now is in herbicide tolerance. It does not reduce herbicide use. So let's just take a quick look at a little case study of methylbromide. Fantastic international environmental agreement, the Montreal Protocol, that we were going to phase out the use of methylbromide. That was the major component of the fumigant that was recommended for the strawberries, methylbromide in conjunction with chloropicrin. So this is a chart looking at yearly applications of fumigants in agricultural fields in California in millions of pounds. Millions of pounds just in California every year. So here's methylbromide, right? So we had an international agreement, and then 2005, it was going to be completely no use in anywhere in the developed year. So the gray is the methylbromide, right? That's over about 4 million pounds in California, and then knocked out completely in 2015. So if we look at this figure and we look at, and a great deal of this is driven by strawberry use, right? And so chloropicrin, which is the orange line, pinkish line here, About 70% of the chloropicrin is used in for production of strawberries in California, right? So what's happened is methyl bromide has in fact gone down because it's gotten more expensive. But chloropicrin has been replaced by chloropicrin and telone 1,3-dichloropropene, right? And then there always was some metam sodium, and that's been replaced by metam potassium to a certain extent. Okay. So what we've done in IPM is to a large extent switch chemicals. We haven't really decreased their use. And these replacement fumigants still have major environmental consequences. And when we look at something like methyl bromide use, a great deal of public money has gone into looking at methyl bromide alternatives. That's largely 1,3-dichloropropene and chloropicrin. A couple of non-chemical alternatives, but very, very energy intensive. And we can ask the question of how have these growers gotten by with continuing to use methyl bromide after it was supposed to be phased out? And what the argument was that was allowed by, which was pushed by the U.S. government, was that if growers had financial profit, they could justify financially that they were going to lose any of their profit, that they should be able to use it, right? And so we have this very complicated situation of justification of use of material so that you can get an absolutely maximum yield without any kind of disregard of what the total cost is. I'm out of time.
I have 3 minutes.
3 minutes. Oh, okay, yeah, great. Okay. So let's just take a minute and look at a neonicotinoid. It's clear that the honeybee problem is has many components to it, but there are many smoking guns from pesticide use. Major one from neonicotinoids, which are systemic insecticides. The major use of neonicotinoids throughout the developed world is as seed coatings, right? And so this is just showing the yearly use of neonicotinoids in thousands of pounds that are sprayed into the field in California, right? And just skyrocketed between 1993 to 2014. Just a brief list of conclusions. I haven't shown you data about all of them. California hasn't really reduced overall agricultural fumigant use between 1993 and 2014, largely because growers expect high yields from monocultures and back-to-back planting. Well, when you're dealing in a monoculture situation, you're really locked into pesticides. And so what happened after the introduction of using fumigation pre-plant for strawberries is all the breeding work that was done in California was all done in fumigated fields. And so they demand high profit, the highest yield, and so that's in a fumigated system. We did have some great successes in California and throughout the U.S. that was driven by the Food Quality and Protection Act back from 1995 and reducing some of the organophosphates, some of the most materials of concern. We still have these large amounts of fumigants which are used, which present human health problems. So a third point, IPM can reduce pesticide use or risk if use is higher than necessary to achieve economic control for the grower. But for the growers, there really isn't the incentive. We present IPM to the public, we say great for the public, great for the farmer. The farmer has to pay all the costs if they have a loss in yield. And so the general strategy for the farmers, particularly of major companies, is to reduce their financial risk. And what that means is they want to reduce their variability from year to year. And so paying for pesticides, which don't cost that much, are a good way of them reducing their risk. So we have to have much broader social ideas about how to reduce pesticide use. And you can can make a good argument that just legislation isn't a good strategy, but I would argue that IPM hasn't been that successful either. And, a lot of interest in now, company interest in introducing biological materials. Historically, they haven't been that successful, except for Bacillus thuringiensis, which has been, and of course is one of the, has been incorporated into genetic engineering. And that has had resulted in some pesticide, reduction in pesticide use, but probably not as much as people would like to believe. And then final, and leads to the next point, is I think that it's unlikely that the current crop of genetic engineering that we have is going to really result in reduced pesticide use. It could, if you were truly incorporating genes that allowed you to reduce pesticide use. But it's with the current, what's going in the pipeline, not so much. So with that, I'm in time?
Yeah, perfect.
Okay.
Thanks so much, Linda. And now we'll have Jeff's presentation.
Thanks. Just to start off by thanking Richard and UC Davis for organizing this. I am a soil scientist with the United States Department of Agriculture with the Agricultural Research Service, but I have adjunct positions at both New Mexico State and the University of Colorado Boulder. And those affiliations are incredibly important, as are the collaborations with universities around the country, including, and I actually came in a bit early to meet with folks from UC Davis. It's a really strong program here and a lot of really good faculty members, so those of you based in California are very fortunate. I should also add that 10 years ago, I graduated with no farming background, a liberal arts degree as an undergrad, like many, I'm sure, in this room, and began farming because I wanted to live in a passive solar adobe house. I wanted to be sustainable. This passive solar adobe house happened to come with 2 acres of flood-irrigated pecans in the desert. This has taught me a lot about sustainability. It's taught me a lot about scale. It's taught me a lot about trade-offs. And I think you saw that very well illustrated, and I'm sorry to have my back to you.
No, that's okay.
In Lynn's presentation as well, and the struggles that we face today. But there are actually some things that we can do, some things that we could have done. Before technology, this was in the 1930s, or at least before the technology that we think about today, the crime of the century, which led to the consequence of crime, images that we've all seen. Rappers like to talk about crime, but actually country talks about crime too, but they talk about agricultural crime. How many people know the song Dirt from Florida Georgia Line? People actually listened. Okay, so I'm not even going to ask them. You listen to the lyrics because you haven't. It's a very, I think it hit, I don't know, top 5, top 10, might even been top 1. So it talks about red dirt roads and the red dirt that they grew up on. Fantastic. I mean, just these wonderful images of just getting down in the dirt. Right? But one of the lines talks about a crime. It was the crime of his great-grandfather that his father paid for. Great-grandfather and grandmother came into a soil that was basically a nice loam, a mix of sand and silt and clay, a nice garden soil. Underneath it was a clay, but that was okay because they were plowing the loam. And when the rain fell, it soaked into the loam. Except when it didn't, because of the practices they used and the cotton they farmed. The result is they lost that loam. And what's exposed now is the clay. And now when it rains, it floods. And it doesn't flood because of climate change, which is what we all like to talk about, right? Climate change is really important. I don't want to downplay it. But I do want to point out that in 1950, when his dad damned his luck on that ground, that's when that CO2 curve really starts to pick up, right? We weren't looking at climate change in 1950, but his dad damned his luck on that land because he didn't pay attention to what that land could sustainably produce and how it could do it. Same thing where I live in Las Cruces, New Mexico, on the Jornada, not where I farm my pecans with water from the Rio Grande. Livestock production. This is all that can be sustained now versus what they were trying to sustain back in the beginning of the 20th century. We've done it again. We brought technology into Bolivia in the form of tractors, a nice NGO that said these poor people need a tractor. They did, their land didn't. That's moon dust, and it's blowing away. They get about 3 or 4 years out of that, and then it's gone. Quinoa's great stuff, right? Healthy, sustainable stuff, I love it. But it's not being sustainably produced. It is bringing a generation out of poverty. The next generation won't be able to rely on it more. Okay, so what can we do? Can we find sustainability in this landscape? In southern Mexico, pastures down here, eroding cornfields up above. Well, if we can match land, so the rest of this, I'm sorry, that was depressing, sorry. But the rest of this is going to be much more optimistic. If we can match land use and management with sustainable potential based on soils, climate, and topography. So if we look at this hill slope, the problem here is actually, it has nothing to do with what I study, which is the soil. It has to do with Tom studies, which is economics. Rich folks own the pasture down here, which should be corn, if we'd actually match land use with its potential, because that wouldn't erode, you could actually produce sustainably. And poor folks are forced up on the hillsides. And Tom's going to say, try and solve that for us. But in the meantime, actually, the poor folks who are up here on the hillsides could be doing a better job of concentrating their resources, their limited resources, on those parts of that hillside that could be, with some conservation practices, sustainably farmed. If they put all of their inputs, all of the manure that they're harvesting from down here or from corrals, all of their any supplemental fertilizer they may be using, all the labor, right, which is a huge input for these folks, and you saw that reflected in Lynn's slide about the energy ratios, right? They're substituting in Kenya, they're substituting their own labor for a lot of our other inputs to produce their corn meals. If you put all those in that small area, this area up here, we're not going to get any grain off this at all. This is an eroded hillside. They planted it, but this year, probably because it wasn't as wet as the wettest years, they probably planted thinking, well, I did get some yield off this during the wettest years. It's going to continue to erode, and it's actually going to deposit the soil down here. And so if we could figure out how to provide people with the knowledge and information they need to match that land use with sustainable potential, and then capitalize on that, we might actually be able to take the innovation, the adaptation, in order to increase profitability. So again, what Tom started with today. So I'm working quite a bit now in Africa. A Namibian workshop participant put it best. We need to see beyond what we see, because that can help you decide what to do next. We need to be able to see beyond in terms of climate change. We also need to be able to see beyond in terms of what other people might be doing to sustainably produce. So, in the rest of my presentation, I'm going to talk about technology. Is more technology the solution? We have an opportunity. Right? This is global smartphone shipment forecasts. Actually, we're not here anymore. We're actually up here. That's 2 billion smartphones. Now, a lot of the smartphones that are sold aren't actually used as smartphones. They're used as dumb phones. Okay? and not just by me. But in Africa, simply because they don't have the data services. But those data services are coming, and they're coming fast. And people are starting to learn how to use these things. So can we do something with those to help people match land use with its sustainable potential? Well, maybe. The internet isn't precise enough. I got a PhD in soil science. I bought a 2-acre farm in southern New Mexico. I thought I knew how to use the internet to get the information that I need in order to sustainably farm that piece of land. It turned out to be incredibly hard. Okay. The extension services have simply not made the information that I need, and the scientists like me, available in a form that I can figure out which information is relevant to my piece of land. We've got, and the soil maps aren't precise enough, so they can't even figure out what my piece of land is. Right. So here's an example in southern Namibia. All mapped is the same soil. This is quite common. You'll find this in California as well, which has incredible soil variability because of the way it was formed through all this runoff from the mountains. not much to do with the earthquakes. Although there are a couple of places where that creates some interesting soil boundaries. So basically, we've got some land here, land that the local knowledge says can be cropped. And in the first year, you don't even need any manure. Right next to a piece of land that is not good for cropping unless it's a wet year and you apply manure. You're gonna put your seeds in the soil and you're going to lose them. Right. So I get on the internet, Northern Namibia, grow corn. And it says, can't do it. Okay, because most of the soils are actually this one. But there are actually some places where I can. And maybe I could convert from being a livestock, extensive livestock producer, which is what most folks are doing here, and produce a little corn on the side, increase landscape scale productivity, and probably sustainability in that case. So if we can combine the internet knowledge and information with crowdsource and local knowledge, actually, we think we can. Okay? But we need to make it easy, we need to make it fun, we need to make it interesting, and we have to make it sustainably profitable. Otherwise, people aren't going to bother. How many apps have you downloaded versus how many apps do you actually use? I don't want to. Okay. Tell me after you adopt the apps you're trying to build. So the way this is being designed is we use the app to get the location, obviously, because that does tie us into a fair bit of information, including climate. And we lead people through the process of describing their soil, telling us, is it actually a sand or a loam or a clay? What's there? Right. With that, then, we can actually go to these global soil databases and predict exactly what their soil is. And that's these are algorithms we're developing as we speak, including with the participation of some folks from UC Davis. We put all that into some models in order to predict what the potential sustainable production is. So on that hillside that I showed you, this app will come back and say, yeah, you can grow corn for about 5 years. Then you're not going to be able to grow it anymore. Your choice. Well, if you're starving, you know what your choice is, right? But if you're not starving, and you've got that other little piece of land down there, maybe you can come up with some other management options, which data will also provide, because we actually have management data knowledge bases. But again, you go and you search those, and it's like, well, which management system is supposed to work for me? Organic. Oh, yeah, organic's good, right? Always, right? It's always going to do better. No, right? Under what conditions, right? We need to match that in order to support those decisions. I'm still trying to move my way towards organic. I tried to go organic immediately, and then I ran into an organic pecan grower, and they said, oh, given how they've been beating your soils over the last 10 years and not putting any fertilizer on, don't even try to use manure. I said, you're going to have to in your situation. I was local knowledge, right? Experience. I didn't have any, actually there are no trials, right? I had to go with that local knowledge, and so I've been putting on mineral fertilizer to try to build things up, and my fertility levels are still really low. And trying to get access to manure for a small farmer, which in a state like New Mexico is not good. All right, it all gets stored in the cloud. The other thing we're trying to do is make this easy, simple, and fun, so it's all icon-based. You get immediate feedback. If you're driving around California and you'd like to know what the climate is at a particular location, there is a single button up at the top of the app. You don't even have to worry about the soil information. It'll actually tell you what your climate is for that location. I'm kind of surprised the weather apps haven't done this yet, but anyway, it was really easy to implement, and so it's kind of a fun feature as you're driving sort of up and down the California. I always look out at the vegetation and I try to guess what the climate is based on the vegetation, but of course it's a function of both climate and soils. And so it's kind of a fun feature. Anyway, there's a data portal you can go in and you can actually click on where people have entered data. We aren't focusing on the United States right now. This is funded by USAID, although in collaboration with NRCS, so you'll see more and more sort of the domestic focus over the years. You go to Namibia and you see quite a lot of points where people have collected data already. The predictive functions that I mentioned are still coming. Yep. Okay. So we can compare across similar types of soils around the world and transfer knowledge that way. And this is just a summary, basically, of what I just talked about. This land potential knowledge system. So if we go back to the internet, one simple trick, right? There's always one simple trick. Match land use to land potential, another simple trick. Let's see if we can use technology to help make it happen for real people on the ground. And finally, I'll just, since we're plugging reports, the International Resource Panel just released a background policy document, basically, on unlocking the sustainable potential of land resources and their information sheets and so forth. download those from UNEP.org. Resource kit. Thanks.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thanks.
Okay, all these presentations are great. And we're going to end with Raul. And we'll have about 10, 15 minutes for open questions.
You're on the lower right.
Here I am.
Yeah.
You could see it because you were further away.
I put it on.
Okay, how about the slideshow?
This is what happens when you're okay. So thank you for inviting me to be on the panel. I hope it's not too self-serving, but I appreciate when there are farmers on panels about agriculture and food because we do play a part and we do have a point of view. I'm not sure if it's my personality or because I'm a farmer, but I take a problem-solving point of view into sustainable agriculture, and I ask, what are the problems and what's the best way to solve them? So, as you heard, there are problems in agriculture, whether it's pesticide use, nitrate fertilizers. This, by the way, is the Gulf of Mexico, where every summer a 6,500 square mile dead zone forms because of all the nitrates and phosphates that have leached out of farm fields and dead algae. But there's soil erosion, clearly, farm incomes. I woke up this morning thinking, oh, there are even more problems I could have put on this slide. And clearly there's social justice problems, and you know, it could be 10 slides, I think. But Sustainable Ag is trying to address all these problems and to make agriculture more productive, more environmentally friendly. So when you're trying to solve these problems sustainably, I think there's a couple of guidelines that are worthwhile. One is that the solutions to the problems are going to be integrated solutions. There aren't going to be silver bullets that instantly solve the problem. There's going to be a whole array of tools you can use, strategies you can take to help solve them. Secondly, they need to be science-based tools, science-based information, because there's an awful lot out there as a farmer that I've seen and experienced that just doesn't work. And also, not only do you want to know about the efficacy, you want to know the impact of what you're doing on the environment, the impact of these new tools on people as well. And a really important point about sustainable agriculture is one size doesn't fit all. There are all kinds of agriculture. There's subsistence agriculture, there's organic agriculture, there's large scale, and the approaches you take to make them sustainable are going to vary. So I hear different people promoting solutions for agriculture, and it just seems like, wow, that's such a generalization. It's not going to be very effective. So coming from both my experience as an organic farmer and a sense of what agriculture is about, I think there are some practices that may help make ag more sustainable. As I say, it depends on the situation. One is crop rotation, reduces pests, reduces soil erosion, and can be used on both small-scale, large-scale farms.
soil building. Clearly, there's a need for soil building in Africa. There's a need for soil building in Alabama. Whether that's adding organic matter like compost or growing cover crops or using no-till, it's going to benefit the soil, benefit production. Again, reducing soil erosion, improves water retention, provides a living soil microbes, food for the microbes to live on. Biodiversity increases beneficial insects, reduces pests and pesticide use. The ills of monoculture have been described for many years, and adding diversity to that, different crops to that, makes a big difference on the ecology of the farm. So improved seed. I'm an organic grower, but I use a lot of hybrid seed, a lot of seed that has disease resistance and nematode resistance and uniformity, and it makes a big difference on yield. It makes a big difference on whether or not I have to apply organic pesticides or try and control pests. So I think it's a significant factor in achieving sustainability. A couple more things, information. When I originally wrote this down, I was thinking, well, these information systems and the drone that collects the information and the satellites are really going to help large-scale farms, but it's going to be expensive. But I'm fascinated, Jeff, that, hey, it's going to help small farms as well, and maybe even more significantly. And so that, you know, light went on. Good. Water-saving technologies are on my mind a lot. We've been in a drought in California, and I use drip systems. A lot of people do, and adding organic matter to the soil, it may be one of the keys to sustainability worldwide, because there's less water available for ag every decade that goes by, either through mismanagement of resources or more demands for urban water or water for the environment. So using it efficiently is going to be really important in developing sustainable systems. So I have an example of these photos. I have an example. Matt Liebman and his colleagues at Iowa State looked at the corn-soybean system that's generally used in the Midwest and added some rotations, some biodiversity, and even a bit of organic matter. And instead of having a corn-soybean system, they had a corn-soybean small grain, meaning wheat or oats or rye, and alfalfa. And having this more extended rotation by itself, they were able to reduce the inputs of synthetic nitrogen, 74%, herbicide use by 82%. In a more diverse field like that, you're going to have more beneficial insects. You're going to reduce the possibility of pest resistance, herbicide resistant by the weed, herbicide resistance by the weeds, insect resistance on either the BT from genetically engineered corn. So in a system like this, those resistance issues don't arise, or they don't arise as quickly. And so also the net returns for this low external input system exceeded the general corn soybean system. So there are models, there is work being done in sustainable agriculture that can work, that can provide benefits for farmers, the environment, and consumers. But clearly, it's an endless process. What Jim expressed, how the IPM system, which was really developed under the idea of generating a more sustainable agriculture hasn't evolved in a way that has reduced pesticides a great deal. So, but it's still something, if it was used like it was envisioned, it could actually continue to add to a sustainable agriculture. And there are, of course, new challenges all the time. There are new pests due to climate change, even on our farm. In the last 5, 6, 7 years, we've had new pests that we've never had before, that California has never had before. Pests moving up from the south or coming in on ships from other continents. And there are really endless challenges. And, of course, there's a role for journalists in all of this, because politics and economics greatly impact sustainability, both in terms of funding for science, regulation, and what choices companies make in terms of developing new technologies. And so if politicians and CEOs can get reliable, science-based information, it may actually influence decisions that they make that can influence sustainable agriculture. And finally, consumers have a big impact on sustainability as well, but they need to be well-informed if they want to be a positive force for change. And so the more that you can do to make that happen, the more that the chances that our agriculture becomes more sustainable is possible. So it's a big job, and we all need to work on it, because in the next 50 years, the population on Earth is going to increase by 2 to 3 billion more. So if we don't succeed, it's going to be ugly. So I hope we all continue to work on it.
Thank you, Raul. Thanks, all our panelists. Randy, Jeffrey, Tom, and Raul, for your presentations. I learned a lot. And I'll open it up for questions. Anybody have a question they'd like to ask? And please introduce yourself, too.
Hi, I'm Carrie So I have a question particularly for Raul, can stand up better, but also for Lynn. I was regularly asked, basically, what should we eat? Should we eat organic? Should we just not care? Should we go with the environmental working group's list? And I'm just interested to know, what decisions do you make and what do you advise that other people do so that they can eat the most sustainably produced food in their area? And think East Coast and not, you know, in California.
Wow. Well, that's an easy one. So I think that in a nutritional sense, eating more fruits and vegetables, almost no matter where they came from, is really important for the individual. And your question is, so if doing that on different income levels becomes a real challenge. Organic food, as I'm sure you've noticed, is quite expensive. And it's interesting, I don't know if Lynn has any information about energy inputs and outputs regarding organic versus conventional, but there are a lot of energy inputs into organic, and the yields may not be as high as conventional. So it's so difficult to evaluate sustainability with all these factors, I don't really have an answer for you. But eating local food is a good idea most of the time, and eating a balanced diet. But
yeah. I have another question, but I just want to let Lynn and Tom want to weigh in on
okay.
that too.
I personally eat organic, not because I think that it's any healthier, but I think that there is more consciousness about the entire food system, although, as Michael Pollan has said, organic in the U.S. floats on a sea of oil. And so...
what does Michael Pollan say?
Organic in the U.S. floats on a sea of oil, something that's a loose quote from him. So, certainly organic uses... often uses more fossil fuel energy for plowing. So I think we are far from getting a full assessment of what's truly sustainable, particularly in the energy use. But I would second what Raul said in terms of encouraging people to eat fruits and vegetables and eating local. And the major issue, I think, in terms of pesticides in the U.S. is on the farm workers and on the people that are surrounding those farms rather than on the consumers.
So nothing we've got now is sustainable. And the challenge is at least two parts. So there's the what we can do as individual consumers and producers, but there's also, and I think journalists have a huge role to play in this, there's a call for citizenship to get there too. In terms of individual consumers, I think if people ate healthier diets, and we have emerging information about what healthier means, there would be environmental benefits of healthier diets. Organic is important. Partially, I think Lynn hit it right. There are health issues of direct exposure for farmers and farm workers in terms of agricultural chemicals that are very important issues. We're only beginning to ask the right questions about how management, so organic versus conventional, translates into nutritional outcomes. And the evidence on that is mixed. My conclusion is we actually need to dive much deeper to understand that. But in terms of the citizenship part, let me use an example from another field. A few years ago, there was a public service spot on public radio here in Sacramento about this new sustainable condo development. And the sustainable condos had all these bells and whistles inside, but, you know, it's the same water system, it's the same transport system, it's the same fossil-based energy system that they're embedded in. So there's never going to be a sustainable condo, and there's never going to be sustainable food production until we address some of these other systems that our economy, our society, our culture is embedded in. And if I had to pick one to start with, I'd actually go with Lynn had picked, talked about energy. I think you need maybe an adjective on there. It's the fossil energy problem. You're talking about petroleum-based.
Yes, non-renewable.
Yeah. So if we could just tackle, if we had a sensible energy policy for the United States that really got the full cost of our energy system right, I think that would take us a long ways on the innovation pathway to more sustainable food system, sustainable built environment, all of those things. We're not going to get there, I don't think, just by individual consumption decisions. It's actually how you vote.
Yeah, I was just asking you maybe follow this up. Anyway, I'm Mark Shapiro. I'm a journalist, and right now I'm writing about seeds. But I was wondering, Lynn, you made a reference to this report about the externalized cost of pesticides. So as this kind of, which, you know, funnily enough, kind of resonates with the climate argument when it comes to fossil fuels and externalized costs. So that concept that begins to be recognized in places like Science Magazine and other places like that, Is this understanding of the externalized costs of the kind of monocultures you're talking about beginning to be reflected in U.S. agriculture policy, which of course subsidizes, chooses basically on a yearly basis, how, what kind of forms of agriculture to support, largely based on economic but also political considerations, obviously. So is this kind of idea, though, of the externalized cost beginning to be reflected in any way in American?
I would say very, very little, and of course, if Trump becomes president, it would be even less.
But in what ways? Let's say there's a tiny little bit, or then it is reflected. What would that tiny little bit, or it's just not at all? How would that be? You got a farm bill, you got all these kind of various.
So you two might be able to talk a little bit more about, you're in the USDA.
So the big one is, and this isn't directly related to energy, but sustainability in general is conservation compliance. So if you want crop insurance now, they did, and actually the Environmental Working Group played a big role in this, they did get into the farm bill, basically. If you are going to farm highly arable land, you can't get crop insurance unless you basically meet certain criteria and conservation plans and so forth. Another good source of information for this, both U.S. and globally, is the International Resource Panel that I mentioned earlier also just released a report on food systems that looks at this sort of life cycle analysis and looks at the various policies around the world that are being used to try to push things in this direction.
Well, I'm sorry, it's called the International Resource Panel?
The International Resource Panel.
Who runs that?
UNEP, United Nations Environment Program. So we have something called the IPCC. Nobody's heard of it. Okay. For climate change?
Yeah.
For sustainable consumption and production, there is also a UN panel. It's called the International Resource Panel, which everybody's heard of.
So this isn't a criticism of our USDA colleague. I mean, Congress drives these allocations. But I think we got this from journalists, right? It's this aphorism of follow the money. So there's two things you might look at. So one is, where does the money go for the conservation programs, the land programs? I think if you look at a map of those allocations, it pretty much is identical to where the old commodity program money used to be. And you understand those allocations by looking at the structure of the Senate and the House of Representatives. So those are politically driven. The House of Representatives and the U.S. Senate, right? They're politically driven decisions. The allocations are not driven by the kinds of things that your information science-based things about where on the hill slope. A lot of it goes to Iowa. Why? You guys know. But the other thing is, and this is going to be a little bit of special pleading because I have a vested interest in agricultural research funding, but our colleagues at Berkeley just did work with – actually, the Union of Concerned Scientists has taken a very important leadership role in this, looking at where USDA agricultural research money goes. A tiny fraction, 3 or 4% of USDA agricultural research money goes into the kind of broader integrated systems work that we're talking about. Okay? So that's why I was saying citizenship matters tremendously in getting us to where we want to be.
So I was wondering, based off of all the press on the recent pollinators, and not recent, it's been going on for a while, but pollinators disappearing, how is it that pesticide was able to skyrocket so much in the past couple of years?
Great question, mm-hmm. Right? And so these are not we don't have the kind, you can make an excellent argument that we really need to back off from the idea of growers decide best to having some more legislative restrictions on when they can be used and whether. And there certainly are situations where honeybees are not present, but there is massive applications when honeybees and wild bee populations are present. And so you can make an argument, again, for an informed citizenry and environmental groups really pressing for some social programs that would prohibit that kind of application.
But Lynn, relative to that, do you think there's enough money going into research on what are the multifactorial causes for a colony collapse disorder?
So,
I mean, do we have the science base to make the regulatory arguments?
I think we absolutely do for some of the major problems with the honeybees.
Okay.
Yeah. And I certainly there are, and other people might have some responses to this as well. But I think that there's plenty of evidence, and that this idea that we just need more study for another 10 years in order to nail that last nail in the coffin to say that, yes, that's why the last honeybee died is not really in our best interest. That we should apply more of the precautionary principle, and if we make a couple of mistakes, those things can be adjusted as we go along, but that we have to be much more proactive about preserving the environment and preserving a sustainable and working towards a sustainable agricultural system.
Could that legislation that you're talking about be done given Washington dysfunction at the state or even county level?
Absolutely.
State level in California.
California has been a pioneer in the regulation of pesticides, and probably even more importantly is we have a tremendous database of pesticide use that doesn't exist anywhere in the world. Every pesticide application in this state has to be recorded and goes into a public database. Colleagues at Davis and other places use this to ask some of these kinds
and
of questions.
That's the data that I showed.
Yeah. But I don't know any other I don't think any other state has...
Not as good of one as California.
And I don't think any other country does.
Not as... Right. Yeah. California is the leader, yeah. And you don't see the data shown very much.
We'll take this last question, then we have to close up. Sorry.
Okay, so I'm Kate Pregeman with the Yakima Herald Republic. I report on a lot of permanent crop agriculture, and so I was just wondering if you guys had anything you wanted to add to sort of the key practices of sustainability, like, you know, we talked about crop rotation and soil building that pertains specifically to permanent crop agriculture, because I just wanted to know what else I should be looking for on that front.
It's difficult to generalize, and it depends what the issues are, where you are, whether it's water penetration into the soil or it's specific insect pests. So it's just very difficult to generalize. Yes, sorry.
Can I just add something? I think there's a tendency, at least internationally, to believe that permanent crops, tree crops, et cetera, are always better. But it really does depend on where they're planted and how they're managed. So a really good example is the Kesengwal agroforestry system emerged, actually, organically in Honduras. And it was a great system. They basically would go in and they would leave selected trees in place, usually producing some sort of fruit or wood or something, some other product. And then they would plant corn and beans underneath. And that system worked really well, actually, on relatively steep slopes because of the stability, inherent stability of these soils. It wouldn't work as well on our loamy soils of eastern Washington and so forth. But it worked pretty well there until they came in and said, hey, we need a more integrated system, not because they thought it was a good idea for sustainability, but because they wanted to pad their bank accounts, because they wanted to get more out of the land. And so they started grazing the crop residues and compacting the soil. They grazed the crop residues during the end of the wet season, compacted the soils, and now, as a result, what was a very sustainable system suddenly became non-sustainable. And so I think that it's the complexity of these systems, especially when you get into permanent crops, where you really do have an opportunity. And I'm playing around with the same kinds of things in my little pecan orchard on how to sort of work with other what I can grow underneath it and how to use that biomass.
Somebody wants to make a compelling point. Then I'll thank everybody and our great panelists and great presentations. And I guess welcome you all to come up and exchange contacts before we go off for lunch. Thank you.
Thank you.